This is Eyes Closed in Prayer. I'm your host, Gwendolyn Glenn. On a recent afternoon, Ed Brosh sat on a wrought iron bench next to a friend. Brosh is from North Carolina, visiting Charleston to take in the city's history. By chance, his visit coincided with the start of an historical trial. Dylan Roof is the first person to be sentenced to death by the federal government for committing a hate crime. Ed Brosh certainly approves.
I mean, it's a hate crime committed on innocent people. That asshole that committed this horrendous crime should be punished to the full extent of the law. I think that the death penalty in this case is definitely warranted.
Justice, Brosh said, should come swiftly.
I don't think it should be dragged out, saving taxpayers money for something that's as cut and dried as this, a heinous crime that he's committed.
In the end, the trial lasted 13 days, pretrial motions and jury selection a few more. And every day court was in session, Alexandra Olgan was there. She's the Charleston reporter for South Carolina Public Radio. Throughout much of that time, she tried to get a feel for Dylan Roof. She says it was harder than you would expect.
During the actual guilt phase of the trial, when he was being represented at that point by his attorneys, he really didn't do much. He just kind of sat there and looked straight ahead. He didn't really show much emotion, at least from my perspective, watching him from the courtroom.
Did that change at all when the family members demanded that he look at them?
No, and that was the thing. The family members kept trying to get his attention and kept trying to force him to look at them. Now, some claimed that they saw him glance up or they felt his breathing change when they were talking, but we didn't really see much of any kind of reaction from him.
The jury found Roof guilty on all counts, a verdict never in doubt. Next, the jury had to decide if Roof would be put to death, and that's when Roof's persona changed from a stoic, emotionalist defendant into something far more complicated.
We hadn't heard him talk at all, and then finally, when he decided to represent himself and he actually started speaking, it felt like this change where he felt a little bit more human because he was now actually talking and we heard him, his voice.
Audio recordings aren't allowed in federal court, but Olgan remembers Roof as being shy, bashful even, more comfortable talking to the judge than the jury. There was more of these brief glances into Roof's mind. There was a journal penned in his cell where Roof said he hoped his crime would not affect his family.
So it's clear that he is capable of feeling, having feelings towards someone or something. He also talked about how he never fell in love, and that's one of the things he regretted. So again, that shows that he is capable of having those emotions.
But Olgan adds that same jailhouse journal showed an abundance of hate.
At one point, he wrote that he did not feel bad for what he did, and he wanted to be crystal clear about that. Those were his words. And he also said he had not shed a tear for the innocent people that he killed.
And innocent people. Those were his words.
He talked about black people, he talked about Jewish people, he talked about Slavs, he talked about Hispanics, how he doesn't like homosexuality, he doesn't like feminism.
Roof's journal was so damning, prosecutors simply had it read out loud in court. On the day the death sentence became official, Grayson Doctor stood up and addressed her mother's killer directly.
She said, "I think that what you did is the one sin that she's not even sure that God could look past." And she said that she hopes that he goes straight to hell.
Her aunt Bethane Middleton Brown had even harsher words.
Yeah, she had a very emotional, empowered speech. She got up and said to Dylan Roof, "You may have killed my sister, but, she's an angel." And then Bethane also talked about how she was searching for this, the worst term that she could use to say to Dylan Roof, and she couldn't come up with the right word, so she just didn't even go there and didn't try and find a word to call him.
For relatives of the victims, the weeks and months after the shooting have featured a series of journeys, each one an incremental step. They are journeys of grief, uncertainty, and resilience. For Bethane Middleton Brown, Grayson, and her siblings, it's also about discovering new ways to define family. They all now live here in Charlotte, and 1 year after the shooting at Mother Emanuel, they share their journey with Mark Rumsey.
It's a pleasant early June morning as a colleague and I walk up to the two-story home on a winding suburban street on Charlotte's north side. But an awkward feeling goes with me. I'm about to meet three living victims of violence. They are a daughter, a sister, and a niece.
Hey.
Hello. Hey. I'm Mark.
Hi, Mark. Come in.
Hi.
Bethane. I'm Bethane. Nice to meet
you.
Already, I feel welcome in the home that Bethane Middleton Brown shares with her family.
Grayson, this is Bethane's eldest daughter. The others will be here.
Hi, Grayson. I'm Mark.
Bethane is the younger sister of the Reverend Bethane Middleton Doctor. She was among the nine parishioners killed at Charleston's Emmanuel AME Church on June 17, 2015.
Dogs outside.
As we settle in around a tall kitchen table, we're joined by Bethane's 19-year-old daughter, Jillian, and by Grayson, age 23. She's the oldest of Dupain's four daughters. The two resident dachshunds, now exiled to the backyard, still serve to help break the ice.
They remind me of me and my sister. Yeah. Because Sophie is very girly, you know, she's very particular, and Nikki is hyper and everywhere. And that was me as a kid, so. And my sister was more reserved. Yeah.
Dupaine Middleton Doctor was the middle child of three daughters born to the Reverend Leroy and Mrs. Francis Middleton. The girls grew up attending an African Methodist Episcopal church west of Charleston, their father, an AME minister. But when Dupaine eventually discerned her own calling to ministry, it led her first to a Baptist organization, where she became an ordained reverend. It wasn't until March of last year that she joined Charleston's historic Mother Emanuel Church and pursued ministry credentials from the denomination of her childhood, as daughter Grayson explains.
She had to pretty much go through the whole procedure again. So even though she was an ordained reverend, she now had to become an ordained reverend in the AME church. And that's what she was going through. So on that Wednesday night, that was completed.
The Wednesday night that Emmanuel AME became a killing ground. Over the past year, it has annoyed Bethane Middleton Brown when a media mention of the nine Charleston victims has failed to include the title reverend when referring to her sister.
Dupaine was an ordained minister long before she went to Emmanuel AME Church. And once there, when she left this world, she was an ordained minister. And I find that that's the biggest pet peeve I have, is that I want her title to be there because she earned it.
The Reverend Dupaine Middleton Doctor was 49 when she was killed. In addition to Grayson, the tragedy left three other daughters without their mother, Kaylin, now 18, Haley, 14, and 11-year-old Zaina. Last fall, Grayson began her senior year at Johnson C. Smith University in Charlotte. Kaylin enrolled as a freshman at Johnson and Wales University, and their Aunt Bethane went to work seeking and eventually gaining custody of the two younger sisters. Dupaine and her husband had divorced in 2012. Bethane was determined to keep her nieces together.
She loved her nieces and nephews. She loved her children. She's the best big sister I could ever have. She never waited for me to ask for anything. I would get care package and my other roommates would be jealous. That was her. She was just really very nurturing to me. Very nurturing.
So it's June, and I wonder what June is feeling like to all of you.
I'll let you start that.
It's better than last June, but, you know, it's still a process. So, I don't know. The days are just, they're just kind of going.
I was real moody. couldn't figure out. You know, it dawned on me at first, and then I started to, Haley asked if we were going to go to church, and we went. And that's when I kind of realized, you know, it's getting closer. So I go between sentimental and mood swings. Yeah.
Did something trigger that?
There's a pause as Bethane gathers herself before responding, and Grayson reaches with a reassuring touch to her aunt's arm.
Just before you came, I said I was already feeling very emotional, but
one of the things is I keep thinking back to my family and I, my husband and my children. We got baptized on December. It was Christmas Eve of 2006. And when I looked up in the balcony, my sister was there. And she was looking down, smiling and waving. She was real happy because that was something she wanted for a while, that we would get back involved in church. So when I go to church, I try not to look in the balcony. And
Bethane explains that on this recent Sunday, something, maybe an amen from the balcony of her home church in Charlotte, caught her attention. Then, suddenly, at this reflective moment in our kitchen table conversation, the mood takes an unplanned turn.
It's my...
The crashing sound is a decorative frame falling from a wall behind us in the stairwell of Bethane's home. She takes it as a message.
That's the pain. Because we put a picture up and we said, with our luck, it will fall down during the interview. So, but the only hard thing that's a trigger, I'm glad it failed, it made me laugh, is just because the pain, that was her stomping ground, church and her singing and being in the choir and being in the pulpit. And when I would go to church, I would come back home and we would talk about when I went to church. I'm like, girl, you won't believe he did it this time. You know, I would tell her what the pastor preached. And it sparked long conversations between her and I. So I miss that. I miss not being able to call her and share what we call our time, you know.
And everything that each of you has been sharing gives me the sense that your sister, your mother, your aunt was a really strong presence.
Mm-hmm. She was. She definitely was.
That was our glue.
Yes, mm-hmm. She was. She was definitely the person to hold everyone, bring everyone together. Mm-hmm. Everyone depended on her. We all leaned on her for everything. Like, I just feel like she was the go-to person for everything. For everything. No matter what.
Her family also remembers the Reverend DePayne Middleton Doctor as a woman who put music into their lives, writing and singing songs since childhood, says Bethane.
The first song, she wrote a song back when, and we used to sing it in the when we take our shower, our bath. So I think she might have been 10 or 11 when she did When We Get to Heaven. And she's been writing ever since.
Grayson adds her mother was always singing, in the kitchen, in the car. And her powerful singing voice can still be appreciated, as in this recording. With the South Carolina Baptist E&M Convention Choir behind her, DePayne Middleton Doctor proclaims the faith that meant so much to her. For Bethane, the journey into a future without her sister seems to have taken on a gentle rhythm.
I started out saying one day at a time, but I'm back to one breath at a time. And I'm comfortable with one breath at a time. So I still am a work in progress. My intentions are still to find forgiveness. I'm still angry. I have hope, but that's where I am.
Was that painful in any way to hear a level of forgiveness or a stage of forgiveness being expressed by some others that didn't seem to match where you were in that process?
It wasn't painful. The only painful thing at that point for me was that I was trying to come to terms with the fact of what had happened to my sister. My intentions, I don't think I'm a bad person. I think I'm a forgiving person. I may not get there when everybody else does. I don't really give a thought to my sister's murderer, and I don't call him by name, and I gladly say I call him Lucifer, because I think that that's what was the spirit that took over him to make him do something as horrific as he did.
Charleston obviously now holds sharply contrasting memories for DePayne's family, but for Bethane and Grayson, other visits over the past year back to the charming city where they both grew up seem to have brought more comfort than pain.
I don't know. I was sad at first, but then it was just beautiful. It was such a beautiful day. And I remember saying, Charleston is so beautiful. It was just so beautiful. I could see the church steeples, and the Battery, of course, wasn't far away. The carriage rides were coming through, and it was just a very serene kind of atmosphere that I felt.
At first, it was hard because I'm so used to going home, you know, of course, to having my mom there. And I was also thinking it was going to be hard every time. Every time I go back, I'm just going to, I don't want to go to Charleston. But it's been the opposite. Like, I get excited to go home, and I definitely feel a sense of serenity when I go there, too, especially when I'm downtown.
Less than a month after the massacre, the Confederate flag was lowered for a final time from its pole on the Statehouse grounds to a chorus of cheers heard well beyond the Capitol. Bethane says taking down the flag was a good move for race relations in the country, but she adds,
I question if it's going to stay that way or will it return. It is my hope that it won't return, that it will stay showcased wherever, and that we will continue to move forward with an effort to improve race relations. I'm a little iffy with race relations because it seems like it just keeps flaring back up.
Like her aunt, Grayson isn't convinced the Confederate flag is gone for good.
I'm not going to say, you know, that we're going to see the flag up on top of the State House again, but who knows? I just, you know, especially with governor changes, you just never know people's mentality, their way of thinking, you know, their background. You just don't know what people could do.
Grayson adds the country can move past its troubling race relations only when people accept the fact that racism still exists.
I think people are in such denial and, you know, they just don't want to face the fact that it's happening. Maybe because, like, it's not something that they've experienced personally.
After the break, the power in symbols of love and hate, and an unexpected irony in Dylann Roof's crimes. You're listening to Eyes Closed in Prayer.